Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of FRCS Eurocast. First of all, I've got to introduce my co-host, Sophia Cashman. Hello, Sophia.
Hi, Harry. I'm Sophia. I'm a registrar in the East of England for about three more weeks.
Oh, yeah, the sands of time are running out in your traineehood, aren't they?
I think they're slightly overcooked as well, don't you?
A couple of things to say. So first of all, thank you all. We've had lots of great feedback from you. Some of it is slightly more bizarre than others. So number one, yes, I know the music's a bit naff. I'm really sorry.
We're on a tight budget. It's terrible. We all agree. Yeah.
But, you know, we'll get Kendrick Lamar to do the intro when we've got a bit more cash. Do you know Kendrick Lamar is, Sophia?
I mean, I do. I'm impressed you do, Harry. Well done.
I've got a 17-year-old son. And the second thing I had to mention, Sophia might make me cut this out, is that a certain anonymous texter told me that, in fact, I'll read the text. It says, "Hey, Harry, good work on the podcast. You and Sophia are like the urological Mulder and Scully."
I think it sounds like we're investigating bizarre things if we say that
I think it's a compliment for you, but it makes me out to be a kind of a alien obsessed fantasist, which probably isn't too far from the truth. I've got to introduce tonight's guest, and we are delighted to be joined this evening by Kim Davenport. Good evening, Kim.
Good evening. Thank you for asking me to come along and do this.
Oh, absolute pleasure to have you on. In fact, we're honoured to have you on the show. And Kim, for those of you who don't know her, I'm sure most of you do, Kim is an endourologist from Cheltenham. And note, I didn't say an endoluminal endourologist because, unlike me, Kim doesn't confine herself to the inside of the ureter. Kim intentionally strays outside the ureter because, as well as being a fabulous stone surgeon, Kim also does kidneys, pyeloplasties, robotic surgery, laparoscopy. So, you know, clearly a highly talented and hugely experienced surgeon. So, Kim, you know the way this works is that Sophia and I have concocted a hypothetical case, which we're going to put to you, and we'll just talk through it, if that's okay.
Yeah, perfect.
So, Sophia, right. Have you got our case of the week?
I do. We have got a 23-year-old woman. She presents with a history of two confirmed coliform UTIs over the last 6 months. And recently she's been getting severe episodic right flank pain, which has been lasting up to 2 or 3 hours at a time. The GP organised an ultrasound in a community, which demonstrated a severe right hydronephrosis and suggested a urological referral. How would you approach that in your practice?
So obviously the first thing I'd do is see her in clinic, and I'm assuming she's presenting electively in this case. Clearly, if she presented actively with her infection and the hydronephrosis, that would be managed very differently. So if I go from the outpatient setting first. So she's a young woman. She's had the infections. I'd like to know what happens when she has the infections. So is it confined to cystitis-like symptoms, or does she actually have renal involvement? Does she have systemic malaise with it? And really, how long does it take for the antibiotics to sort things out? Because these are all quite relevant. Because what I'm trying to work out is the hydronephrosis is incidental and she's just a young lady with recurrent UTIs, or is her hydronephrosis actually the source for her infection? So that's the first thing I'm trying to work out. With regards to pain, we're looking for kind of typical features for her pain, which would be triggered by excessive fluid intake, particularly anything that's diuretic, so caffeine or alcohol. Typically, the pain would be extremely severe, put you to bed. Often patients having about a hot water bottle on there may well have signs of erythema or ebignee from that. So pain is pretty severe. It limits what they do at the time, and very classical generally. Moving on from that, I'd also want to know if she'd had any history of any problems in childhood. Often this can present, so if you have hydronephrosis, it could have been picked up on antenatal or postnatal ultrasounds. So I'd want to know if this was ever an issue in the past or if this was truly new to her. Again, has she had UTIs when she was a child? Moving on to looking at her renal function. So the ultrasound, we say in severe right hydronephrosis. I don't have an AP diameter on that, but I'd want to know roughly what sort of diameter her pelvis is and cortical thickness, because obviously that's going to be very relevant as to how good this kidney is and where we go from here. Urinalysis, because I want to see if she's got chronic infection. if the infection is actually in the hydronephrosis, then they'll often have positive dipsticks, even if they're not symptomatic in between time. So that's kind of the way I would approach her initially in clinic. We would need to know, obviously, the cause of her hydronephrosis. So if she's got triggers for her pain, then I'd give her advice about that while we're doing the investigation. So I'd give her advice to try and avoid alcohol, particularly high volume alcohols, and to try and spread her fluid intake throughout the day rather than kind of going for a run and then necking a pint of water, because they can often trigger it. If she looks like she's got chronic infection, then I'll often start them on prophylaxis at this point so that we can try and keep that behaving in the background while we're investigating. So investigations wise, obviously we need cross-sectional imaging. Certainly in my trust, there's lots of arguments about imaging in a 23-year-old woman. I don't know if that's the issue everywhere, but our radiologists are very keen to avoid overly irradiating these patients. So first line invariably ends up being a CT-KUB rather than anything more detailed.
Is that a non-contrast scan?
Yeah, generally, if we can get them to do a CT. So with her, because she's... So first line is ultrasound. They will any renal angle pain, colic presentation, it's always an ultrasound in this age group, female. If there's hydronephrosis, then they'll let us go on to do a CT scan. But it generally, by the time they get to me, they've had a CT-KUB rather than anything with contrast. So a CT-KUB can still give you a lot of information. What I want to know is obviously the degree of hydronephrosis, the cortical thickness again, and whether there's any hydroureter or not. And I think you can still pick up most of that on a non-contrast CT. You'll often see if there's a crossing vessel, if there's an issue at the PUJ side of things. And clearly we're going to manage something that is an isolated hydronephrosis very differently than if she's got a hydroureter, say, all the way down to her bladder or a cutoff somewhere.
If you had the option, like say it was a 63-year-old, would you prefer to have a contrast CT, or do you think it's not really needed?
I think they're a very different group. If you're looking at a 66-year-old, if you're looking at that, you've got to look for your red flags and you really want to exclude an upper tract lesion. The evidence is increasingly that portovenous phase of CT would be far better than actually a urographic phase for picking up an upper tract lesion. So that would be my preferred if it was an older age group presenting in this case.
So presumably you're looking for like an enhancing soft tissue lesion rather than a filling defect, because presumably in high grade obstruction, you're not going to get your urographic phase.
Exactly. Yeah. So how often do you actually get that layering of contrast and a big gap with just no contrast at all? And you just get no information, or the kidney's not even functioning enough to give you any information. So if you do it in the portovenous phase, then you get an enhancing lesion and you much higher pickup rate.
Kim, this might be a very old-fashioned practice, but is there any mileage, or do people still do retrograde studies as a separate procedure? You know, not as part of the subsequent surgical management, but just to take them to theatre for a diagnostic retrograde. I presume that's fairly historical.
I think it depends on your case, doesn't it? If your CT is diagnostic, then you wouldn't need to. I've got a young patient that is really proving very difficult to prove that she's got a PUJ obstruction. And I am planning on scoping her and retrograde. So there are certain cases, but it's certainly not first line, second line. It's down the line, basically, or with recurrent PUJ obstructions or, you know, something that's more complex.
And you spoke about not knowing about the function of that kidney. I assume the next line would be going to do a renogram.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously there's different types of renograms. And depending on the severity of hydronephrosis and the cortical thickness would really depend on what modality I would use. So if there was significant cortical thickness, I may well go for a DMSA first, because I'm less interested in the drainage and I'm more interested in actually the function of that kidney. If the function is only, 7%, 10%, you're not going to be going down the line of any sort of reconstructive surgery, and therefore you don't really need, or you're probably not going to get that much more information on a functional scan anyway.
Oh, sorry, Kim. So just to clarify, so if there's a lot of cortical loss, then you would go for a DMSA rather than a...
If the kidney looks really, really chronically affected, yes.
But let's assume a hypothetical young lady has got reasonable cortical thickness on her ultrasound, then I presume you'd be looking more at a dynamic renogram.
Yeah, so a MAG3 renogram. And my preference personally is an F-15. I've never really used F plus 20s. I know they use them a lot in paediatrics, but certainly for the adult population, an F minus 15 is far preferable. It leads to a lot less or a lot fewer equivocal scans, although they are still pretty common. But yeah, they're much better because you'll get an assessment of function. The function assessment isn't quite as accurate as you get with a DMSA, hence why if I'm really concerned about the function, I'd go for a DMSA. But very good at giving you a drainage curve that will give you an idea of hopefully unobstructed, equivocal or obstructed from the three curves that you can achieve from that.
And we won't grill you on the intricacies of MAG3 renograms, Kim, because
we will do a podcast on it.
We've got a whole podcast coming up at some point with a radiologist who hopefully will be able to enlighten all of us on that. But I mean, classically, we get the obstructed type 2 curve, don't we, with a good going PUJ.
Yeah, so you're looking really for either a flat lining curve or a curve that just continually goes up. The higher the peak, then obviously the more worried you're going to be on that curve. But I think you very much have to tie it in with symptoms. I don't think renograms are... It always amazes me how much we put on the preoperative renogram, and yet postoperatively we put a lot less on it. So I think you have to tie it in with the symptoms. So if you've got a classical history, which is causing significant issues, and you've got... Even if you've got equivocal, equivalent function between the two, if you've got a good going up, going curve, then I would say that's what needs intervention. Certainly in this lady with her infections and her severe hydronephrosis, obviously we've not said what the CT showed, but I'm assuming because the podcast is on PUJs, this was all very consistent with a PUJ obstruction. So I would suspect with what she's got, she probably hasn't got a 50-50% functioning kidney. I suspect she's going to have dropped function on that side, which is going to drive your intervention more as well.
Is it kind of the usual scenario that they have lost a bit of function by the time they come along to see us in secondary care?
It's extremely variable, really is. I mean, the symptomatic ones you tend to think may have dropped some function, but no, I mean, you can get people completely asymptomatic and they've got appalling function, and you can get the really symptomatic ones that have still got equal split function. So I don't think you can call it.
Moving on then, let's say she does the renogram and she's unequivocally obstructed, because life in podcasts is always
crystal
straightforward
clear.
Crystal clear, unlike the real world. So she comes back to see you, Kim, with her renogram result. So how are you going to counsel her from now on?
So obviously I'd take into account the CT findings as well. So I'd want to know what the anatomy is. I'd be looking for a crossing vessel, looking where her hilum is, anything that might complicate surgery. But that's where I'm heading. So gold standard would be laparoscopic pyeloplasty. And when I say laparoscopic, I mean robot-assisted or laparoscopic. What I explain to patients is that the goals of surgery are to help her pain and maintain function. So I do stress to patients that it's very unlikely that we're going to gain function back. It has been done, but you know, they need to be clear that if they've got a 37% functioning kidney, it will likely still be around that postoperatively. We really want to get her pain better. We want to stabilise the renal function. And the way to do that with the best success rates would be to do, I would personally do a robot-assisted laparoscopic pyeloplasty. The old school was an open pyeloplasty. The evidence these days is that robotic is probably almost now as good as open. Traditionally, it was slightly lower when we were doing laparoscopic. I think robotic has completely turned everything around. Suturing is so much easier. It's a lot more straightforward operation. When I first started, I used to do it retroperitoneal laparoscopic, which was an absolute nightmare. I used to hate that operation. So having gone on to robot-assisted transperitoneal, that has completely... It's such an enjoyable operation now. So I'd take her through the procedure, obviously. So depending on how much you want to go through the full setup, I would explain to her that she is likely to have four ports. I tend to draw it out for her, explain that we're likely to take the bowel down to access the kidney. And obviously the way you do the pyeloplasty, there's various options been described over the years. So you've got the Anderson-Hines dismembered, there's a YV plasty, Culp's, there's various different ways. But I typically would use the Anderson-Hines, and I think most people would now.
Is there any evidence of one over the other? Has that ever been looked at?
I think there's probably more evidence for Anderson Hines than any. The advantages mm-hmm. of the Anderson Hines is it's the only one that actually dismembers. So if you've got a crossing vessel, you have to move the anastomosis anterior to the crossing vessels, and none of the others will really allow you to do that. So,
what proportion of patients will have crossing vessels, Kim?
So the literature would indicate about 50%. Interestingly enough, surgically, I would say it's significantly higher than that, 80-90%. I think I can probably remember two or three that have not, no, probably maybe a few more than that, but that haven't had crossing vessels that need surgery. So I don't know if it's more that those that have got the crossing vessel are more likely to need surgery. I suspect that's probably more the case, but certainly the vast majority do have a crossing vessel. I think the other ones, much less common. So yeah, I would tend to do a dismembered. It also gives you the ability to remove some of the pelvis if you need to, if you've got a grossly dilated pelvis. Talking her through it, I would draw out exactly how we would do it, and I would give her the Bowes patient information leaflet as well, which also has all the diagrams in there. The key features are that you need to obviously mobilise the ureter and the renal pelvis, but you don't want to mobilise the ureter too extensively. Clearly, it's very important to maintain the blood supply to the ureter. Once mobilised, then I would dismember and then aim to do the anastomosis anterior to the crossing vessel. It needs to be tension-free like any ureteric anastomosis. We always spatulate the ureter laterally and the renal pelvis medially due to the blood supply for the ureter. It needs to be tension-free and it needs to be stented. I think there are a few papers on stent-free. I don't think I'd be brave enough at the moment. I'm going to stay with stents at the moment.
It's probably a bit like wireless ureteroscopy in that you can do it, but why on earth would you do it? Yeah. Exactly.
Do you ever do a retrograde stent at the beginning?
No.
I know some do.
Never have.
Is that just preference or because it's challenging? Or
I don't have any issues with antegrades. Like I said, I've had one that I've had to go back in and bring down, so I don't really see a need to do it. You know, if I've mm-hmm. had any difficulties in diagnosis, I've probably already sorted that before I get there. If I hadn't, I would do a retrograde pre-op, but I think I would still put the wire in antegrade. I just think it's mm-hmm. it's far nicer doing your anastomosis without having a stent in the way. You know, I like all the handling without the stent in the way, really.
And what do you use to do your anastomosis?
So monofilament, absorbable, tend to use 4-0 monochrome. And I do an apical suture. I then do a continuous posterior wall and then a separate continuous anterior wall. So that way, if any of them give, your anastomosis will hold. So the apical and the posterior wall is done first, then put the sensor wire down. I normally use a 626 so that we can really be on a stent, so that we're really quite sure it has reached the bladder. I know colleagues have put methylene blue into the bladder to see if it refluxes. I think if it doesn't reflux, doesn't mean it's not in the bladder. I've never used that really. I've never really felt the need to, but I think some people do to try and confirm that it's definitely in the bladder.
And do you put a perinephric drain in as well,
yeah.
Kim? And does that just come out through one of the robot ports?
Yeah, so I tend to sit it near the anastomosis, not completely on it, but close to the anastomosis. And then try and close a bit of peritoneum over the top. So just try and hold it. You can see on x-rays it doesn't always hold. And then it comes out through the iliac fossa port.
What are the common complications that you might warn the lady about when you're counselling her?
Well, I think the really important thing is to explain the chances of success and what success means. So quoted success rates are between 90-95%, so it's not 100%. And I always explain that to them, that anything can scar down again. So, you know, that we spatulate to try and minimise that risk. We stent to try and minimise that risk. You don't mobilise quite so much to minimise that. So we do everything we can, but sometimes it does reobstruct, and we know that. So they need to be clear, 90-95%. And I say to them that if it's going to fail, they tend to fail early. You tend to know that 3-4 months' time at that follow-up visit. Obviously, the other risks would be that if there's risk of injury to other structures, so you've got the bowel, the duodenum often will be around when you're on the right-hand side. Bleeding, infection. Bleeding's actually very low risk. I was talking to a patient yesterday, you know, we've always quoted the risk of conversion. Actually, it's very, very unlikely that you're going to convert, because actually doing a pyloplasty, I think now, is generally probably more tricky to do it open than to do it robotically. So bleeding, infection, injury to other structures, failure, stent symptoms, obviously they need to be aware of that. Although they don't seem to get the symptoms to the same degree as stone patients. Don't know why that is.
That's weird.
Yeah, that's just my gut feeling. They just don't. It's like the patients that are stented for malignancy, isn't it? They don't seem to, a lot of them,
be bothered as much as stone patients, yeah. And in terms of your drain and your catheter perioperatively, how do you manage those? When does what come out?
So I've got a very set protocol, because I've had drains removed at the wrong times regularly. Myself and my colleague, we both do them, and we do them exactly the same way so that we don't confuse people. Traditionally, they're done in the morning. We then aim to do a plain KUB after 6 when they're a bit more with it, and that's to check the stent position. If we're happy with the stent position, then obviously monitor drain output overnight. And when they're seen first thing in the morning, we look at drain output. If the drain output is less than 50 mils, then the catheter will come out. So they're twopped. They then have their drain output monitored for 4 to 6 hours. And if it's still minimal, the drain comes out and they go home day one post-op.
If the drain output's more than 50 mils, presumably you leave the catheter in for a little bit longer, do you?
Yeah, but I think you have to immediately start thinking why. So obviously, if they've had a difficult procedure and you think, okay, they might be leaking from their anastomosis, then fair enough. But generally, if you're getting increased urine output, my experience is it's normally the stent's not in position. They're the only ones I've ever seen. Because a robot, you know, doing it with a robot, your views are so good that I think your anastomosis is actually very unlikely to leak unless it's really forced. So that's generally the only ones that we've had leaking in our centre have been the stent not in position. So one was an unknown urethra seal, which for my colleague, so obviously went back in. So it looked like the stent was in position. But when they went in, actually had a urethra seal. So as soon as that was repositioned, the drain dries up immediately. And I had one that hadn't reached the bladder and actually had a very distal ureteric stricture, which wasn't the primary problem. She was definitely a PUJ, but it just meant the stent hadn't gone the whole way.
Okay.
And that tends to be why I use the 26, so that you really are sure it's hitting the bladder.
Yes, yeah, so even if it's a little kind of short patient, you'd still use the
maybe
the longer...
not. I mean, yesterday I had a 6'3" chap who was all long torso, and I actually increased the length of his. And okay, he's got a bit in his bladder, but I was absolutely happy that that was in.
Okay, so let's fast forward then. So our patient's delighted with your brilliant surgery, Kim. So she's had her drain and catheter removed and she's off home. So how long are you going to leave the stent in and how are you going to follow her up?
So we leave stent in 3 to 4 weeks and we plan for a flexible cystoscopy and stent removal at that time. I tend to do it with gentamicin cover, just to minimise infection, especially with her. Incidentally, the other thing I would tend to do with her, because she's had UTIs and we think that that was in the kidney, you know, originating in that hydronephrotic kidney, I would often give them a more prolonged course of prophylaxis afterwards just to try and eradicate it, and then give antibiotics at the time of the stent removal and then stop everything. I'd make sure they've got contact details for me, and I do say to them that if they start to have any problems before their renogram, which is planned at 3 months, then they must get hold of us earlier on. I've had one that failed immediately on removing the stent. His was a really complicated case, but they need to know they can contact you and it's not normal to have pain like that. Otherwise, they would have a MAG3 renogram, again, an F-15, so that we can do like-for-like comparison at 3 to 4 months post-op, so 3 months after the stent comes out.
You mentioned the not normal to have pain afterwards. Do you ever get the slightly challenging case of the people that have persisting pain with good renograms afterwards?
Not that often, actually. Surprisingly enough, they might have a very different type of pain. You know, the kind of post-op, I've had surgery kind of, oh yeah, I'm sore in this port site or something. But don't often get severe, you know, very obvious same pain. Without something showing up on the renogram. Often then more likely that their symptoms have actually got a bit better, but the renogram doesn't look quite as you would want it to do.
And when do you, so if they had a good renogram, they were very happy, would you continue to follow them up or do you discharge them at that point?
Depends on their drainage. So if they mm-hmm. have an absolutely amazing downward going curve with maintained function at the 3-4 months, then I would tend to do a telephone follow-up at a year and just make sure mm-hmm. and, you know, reassess their symptoms, do their renal function and make a decision then whether I do another one at a year. And I'd have a low threshold at a year unless it looked absolutely amazing. And we all know generally they don't look amazing afterwards because they tend to have baggy pelvises. So.
But if it was stable at that year point, you'd be happy.
Yeah, I would, because, you know, the literature, we did a lot of work when I was in Bristol. The literature basically supports if they're going to fail, they fail at that 3-4 month point. We've all seen them recur, you know, 10 years down the line, but that tends to be a bit more gradual onset, doesn't it?
And in terms of, we've talked about the operative management in a young, fit patient. At the other end of the spectrum, the, you know, perhaps less fit or the slightly older, is there a role for other options for managing them? Like, do you ever survey them?
Yeah. So there are a group where you find it as an incidental finding. They're completely asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. You do the renogram, they've got impaired drainage, but good function. So, you know, 40 mm-hmm. to 50% function, then I think it's entirely reasonable to survey them. But very mm-hmm. much with that proviso that they've got a contact number, they know what symptoms, and I say typical pain, and I go through that with them. Do say hematuria even in that group and the recurrent UTIs, and I want to know about any of those. Obviously, you want to make mm-hmm. sure they don't have stones. If they've got stones in an incidental asymptomatic, you're going to still treat those. Otherwise, I think it's reasonable. And there's not a lot of evidence out there. I think it's something that's been looked at more and more recently, mainly driven by the paediatric population. We all know that hydronephrosis on antenatal scans is anything up to 1 in 500. And yet PUJ obstruction in adulthood is about 1 in 1500. So there's a significant amount that do improve with no intervention. So I think it's reasonable as long as you've got a very sensible patient who will tell you if anything changes. I don't just see them in discharge. I would tend to do a 6-month renogram so that I can look for any early changes, even if they're asymptomatic.
And are there any that you would manage just with stenting?
Yeah, obviously unfit, elderly, anybody who doesn't want surgery, you know, mm-hmm. a significant procedure like a pilonephrectomy.
Yeah.
So it tends to be the more unfit group. Often these are the more elderly patients that present with an infected obstructed kidney, aren't they, typically, and we stent those.
Yeah.
On that note, obviously if the 23-year-old came in with an infected obstructed kidney, which looked like it was a PUJ obstruction, I wouldn't advocate stenting them. I would advocate primary nephrostomy for those. And that's based on the fact that it gives us quite a few advantages. It's obviously very good drainage. You can then do your renogram to assess their function with the nephrostomy clamp. So you've still got very good mm-hmm. information on drainage and function then. But it also takes out that horrible effect that stents have on ureters. So I do absolutely try my best to avoid having to do a pyeloplasty on a stented ureter because they're not fun. They're so edematous, it's obviously difficult to dissect out first. Once you do dissect out, ureters can be so edematous that your sutures are just cutting through. So not a fan of that.
Kim, if someone has put a stent in, and, you know, we appreciate that sometimes these cases are done in the middle of the night and the patient's been stented and it's clearly regrettable because it would have been better to have a nephrostomy, but would you take the stent out a couple of weeks before the surgery then?
Yeah, ideally. You want a week or two.
How long does it take the ureter to settle down, do you think?
I think if you can do a week or two, that will at least help. Because obviously you don't want to leave it too long, especially if they've been stented. Obviously, if it's been stented for pain, that's a bit more reassuring. But if they were stented for an infected obstructed kidney, it's going to be very difficult to do that safely. And you may not be able to do that.
Yeah, and then just a final question from me, really, on, you know, certainly when I was preparing for the exam, that there were some studies looking at alternatives to pyeloplasty, so things like balloon dilatation or laser endopyelotomy. I understand that all these things have kind of faded into obscurity for primary treatment. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, kind of early 2000s, we were doing quite a few of endopyelotomies, either anti-grade or retrograde. Became a lot safer when we had endoluminal ultrasound to be able to at least tell where the crossing vessel is, because that's the main risk is doing a an endopylotomy and not having any idea of where the crossing vessel is. There were incidences, obviously, of quite significant bleeding with those. But certainly, we when I was in Bristol, we went through a lot of the endopylotomies, and they've got a very high failure rate, about 50% failure rate. So I suppose if you've got somebody unfit who's really struggling with stents, I don't know, you might consider it, but it really has gone out of favour. I've never done one. I don't think Bristol are offering them anymore. So Bristol tends to be our tertiary referral centre. So, you know, when we get the recurrent pyeloplasties, we tend to refer them down to Bristol, and they are invariably treated with a redo laparoscopic pyeloplasty rather than any of these other methods.
That's interesting. So even for failed primary pyeloplasty, the second line is actually to just do it again.
Yeah, so we would refer down to them, and they have very good success rates. And certainly higher than the 50% you would get with an endopylotomy.
Yeah, and as our great mate Jake Patterson says, balloons are for parties, not for Europeans.
They're not great, are they?
Great, thank you. Well, I think that was an amazing overview. I've certainly, again, learnt lots to keep down. Is there any final things that you think candidates would need to know for the exam, or any key papers or anything, or is it kind of a evidence
I think the,
issue, area.
The main thing is there isn't that much evidence, obviously. The only thing with PUJs is just remembering the same principles as any sort of ureteric repair, really. That's a really key thing with these, the tension-free anastomosis, the bridging it, the stenting, the spatulation, being aware of the blood supply. You know, they're all really key to whether this is going to be a success or not.
Perfect, thank you.
It's one of those things that very occasionally an adventurous examiner might get you to draw an Anson Hines dismembered pyloplasty. I think, you know, certainly that I'm aware of some people that get asked that.
And
so
that,
I guess
that
just
really shouldn't be that daunting, actually, because just use the same principles as you would with a ureteric repair.
Kim, thank you so much. That really was fantastic. Sophia, any closing comments from you?
No, definitely not. Apart from the fact that you wanted to mention an email for feedback.
Oh, yeah. Email address. So if anyone wants to get in touch with any feedback, good or bad, it would be gratefully received. Or if you've got any suggestions for topics that you think we ought to cover, or suggestions of any speakers that you're aware of that might want to come and be a guest on the podcast, that'd be fabulous. The email address is urologyresource@gmail.com, all one word, urologyresource@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Today's episode was brought to you by me, Harry Rattan, consultant urologist in Nottingham, Sophia Cashman, soon to be senior clinical fellow in Nottingham, and of course our special guest Kim Davenport, consultant urological surgeon from Cheltenham. Stay tuned for more episodes coming up very soon, but until next time, take care.